From the Sky News Centre at 5, a man's been found guilty of murdering his estranged wife, their young son and his father-in-law in an arson attack. 24-year-old Danai Mohammadi and his friend Farhad Mahmood, who's 35, squirted petrol through the letterbox of their house in Kent and set it alight. It's after Mohammadi's marriage to his wife Melissa Crook collapsed. The two men have been found guilty of 3 counts of murder. Melissa's mother, Amanda, managed to escape the burning building in Chatham.
There's days when you just can't believe it. There's still days when it's not real, it's not happened, and you're going to wake up. We're never going to get over them.
14 people, including 2 youths, have been sentenced to a total of more than 70 years behind bars for their part in riots in Nottingham. A police station was targeted during the disorder last summer. Ireland has officially passed the European Fiscal Treaty with a resounding majority in the country's referendum. Just over 60% were in favour. Unemployment across the Eurozone has risen to the highest level since the single currency was created. Figures for March and April show a record 11% jobless rate across the Eurozone. It means more than 17.4 million people are out of work. And people celebrating the Diamond Jubilee can now check if they have a royal connection, at least below stairs. 250 years of employee records from buildings, including Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, are now online. The jobs included mould taker, chocolate maker to the Queen, and keeper of lions in the Tower. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Cover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is the new UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke North, Ben Walker. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the secret rulers of the NATO world are meeting as we speak near Washington in the heart of military-industrial complex country. So who's there and why are the press and public both being kept away at the point of a machine gun? Plus, Operation Paperclip and the Nazi capital flight scandal. Where did all the Nazi loot end up? Why did the Allies allow scores of Nazi war criminals and billions of dollars worth of Nazi loot to be smuggled out of Germany in the closing months of World War II? And where did it all end up? Martin and Summers and I have a special report. Also, an antidote to the Diamond Jubilee, as we hear from the author of a new book on the death of Princess Diana, which uses evidence submitted to the inquest but never seen by the jury, and explains why he believes a senior royal may have given the order to assassinate Diana and exactly when and why that happened. Plus, Martin Summers weekly roundup of global events. That's in the second hour after the Murdoch news at 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and some light rain. Double bank holiday, of course, this Jubilee weekend. Bank holiday on Monday and Tuesday. Highs of 16 Celsius, some sunny spells and plenty of showers, especially on Monday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of June, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers continuing. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And I suppose the lesson from the weather there is it's going to be total potluck as to whether your important celebration that's going on outside gets a shower or whether it doesn't. OK, so joining us for this week's news review is the new UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke North. That's Ben Walker. Hi, Ben. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, first of all, you have really gone over to UKIP this week. Can you just give us an idea and explain why people voted in a Conservative councillor and what they've now got is not a Conservative councillor but a UKIP councillor?
They have, yeah. I'm quite sorry about that in a way, to be honest. But in the particular seat that I'm in, I do believe that I took out a Liberal Democrat to be elected, and I do feel that there was a large element of the personal vote with me. Of course, that's going to be a Conservative vote, but you know, my job is still to represent them, and I've been doing a good job at that so far, I believe, and I'll continue to do that.
Now, you were the mayor, I believe, of Bradley Stoke for 2 years, and you would have been expected to become South Gloucestershire Council chairman last week, but instead someone else was nominated. Isn't this maybe just a bit of sour grapes there?
No, the truth of that is I actually deferred the chairmanship. I decided I didn't want to take it, and that was 2 weeks before. So that's why someone else was nominated. That's quite straightforward, to be honest.
So what are the main reasons, anyway, for you deciding that you didn't want to stand with on the Conservative ticket anymore?
Main reasons, I can't support us underwriting a failed super state anymore, i.e. the European Union. I would very much like to see this country withdraw.
But, I mean, there's a big, big part of the Conservative Party that would totally agree with you on that.
Yeah, absolutely, there is. There is. One of the most upsetting things for me, being a Conservative then, was that as soon as the government were kind of in control, there was a big push on, well, let's do consultations, you know, let's find out what the British public want. They did that, and there was a big push via sort of websites and the government websites. They got the results on one of them, and it was, well, you know, we'd like a question asked in the Houses of Parliament, in or out. And that was it. And then there was a three-line party whip, and it was a big no. And, you know, that wasn't democracy at its best, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, surely all of the main political parties are like this, aren't they? There's a leadership which leads from the front. When the party conferences happen, increasingly over the last 20, 30 years, they've become less about making policy for the leadership and much more about really a sort of a bun festival where everybody is looking up at the top and admiring and clapping the leadership. And it's really about galvanising the membership support behind the leadership. So, I mean, there's nothing different in the Conservative Party. All the parties are like that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the big three generally are, and I think there is a huge apathy towards British politics now, and that has a lot to do with it. I don't think people have the appetite for the way that the parties run nowadays.
Okay, so what brought you to the Conservative ticket in the first place? Why Conservatives and not, say, the Liberal Democrats, for example?
Right. I don't know how to answer that without sort of saying some quite strange words. But no, seriously, when I was at school, I mean, my background is working class. My dad was always Labour. My dad's dad was a shop steward. And I come from a strong Labour background. However, I went off and I joined the Royal Navy and such like. And my views were sort of slightly different. But having said that, my social morals are very intact. And I think that's also what made me always sort of a little bit awkward, you know, placed quite awkward within the Conservatives as well.
No, I would be. It's strange to hear that, because surely for someone that's been in the Navy, you're used to sort of rigid discipline. You have to do what you're told. Yeah. You're not the sort of person I would expect to, if I can say this, jump ship.
Pardon the pun. But no, you're absolutely right. You know, yeah, I am one for following orders. The trouble is, I mean, there's orders that make sense that you can follow and you can see a reason for doing them. And there's ones that don't, and I feel that there's a lot of those being bandied around within the Conservative Party at the moment.
But I mean, is the European Union, which you cited as the main reason, and the Eurozone for leaving the Conservatives, is that really a big issue in Bradley Stoke?
Yes. People wouldn't think it is, but it is. When you have a country that's only in charge of basically 25% of its lawmaking, the rest is being directed from the European Union and unelected bureaucrats. You know, you've got things being rolled out now, even from local authorities, and that's driven from Europe. People won't realise that, but that you know, that generally is the case. What I would say is that Europe is one of the major reasons for me, but it's not the only one.
Okay, what are the other reasons then?
A lot of my problem at the moment was with the spending, you know, the cuts, the government cuts, spending reform as such. Whilst I support that, I think that has to be done. You know, it's sensible to do step changes and sort of develop things. I think a lot of them are ill-targeted, and I think they're moving in the wrong direction and they're affecting the wrong people. Link that to Europe. When you're spending 50 million a day being part of the European Union, and you've got some of our most needy and vulnerable people in this country facing deprivation and poverty, I just find that a bitter pill to swallow. And also, with time done, I was a big team player in the Conservatives, and I found I actually became a threat to certain individuals, and then fell foul of an internal smear, which for me, I didn't like that very much, you know, and that kind of was the final nail in the coffin for me.
Well, you're talking about the cuts. Before we hear from Martin Summers, we're actually going to do a special report now on what's happening here in Bristol, because right across the country, Remploy, which is a special set up by originally after the Second World War to help injured servicemen, it's an employment facility particularly targeted at disabled people, with some special facilities for the disabled. That is being going through a consultation over 2 weeks at the moment, and it looks as if the Bristol part of Remploy may well close, even though it itself has a full order book and is turning a profit. So I went round down to Remploy earlier this week, which is down near Old Market, just around the back of Old Market. It's really tucked away, actually. People may not know it's there. And I couldn't actually go into the building. I wasn't allowed into the building. So when everyone finished at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they all came outside the gates and had a chat to me there. But here's a special report now on what's actually going on here in Bristol at the government's Remploy office, which is facing closure.
My name's Tina Fellows. I'm senior team leader at Remploy Bristol. We're under threat of redundancy under our 90-day consultation at the moment to decide what they're going to do with us. And I feel that as a productive factory as we are, there is no need to do that to us. We've got the work. We've got plenty of work. Remploy was first started after the war for disabled servicemen. And we look after a lot of disabled people. A lot of disabled people have come through Remploy, been here 30, 40 years. We train them to do various jobs. They're productive and they need to stay in a job. We do document management. So we prep, scan and index work, put it on different medias for people.
Is that sort of turning a paper office, for example, into an electronic office? You're going to need to scan quite a lot of stuff in to do that.
Yeah, of course. And we've got some really big names on our book. We do work for the NHS, places like Honeywell, Environment Agency. The work's there if the government can keep us open.
Well, the government's saying, I'm afraid, that you're just not financially viable.
All right, we've got a big factory. If we had a smaller factory, the overheads wouldn't be so big. But we're very productive. We make money. There are factories that don't do that. And maybe they do need to look at them. If they're not working here and they're not being funded here, they're going to go on to the unemployment system. They're not going to be protected as they are here. They're not going to be looked after as they are here.
I'm Paul Gain and I'm a factory operator. I prep the paperwork for the scanners, and it's a shame, really upsetting a lot of people, because future disabled children who's in school now, they're not going to have the opportunity to achieve anything because the government has taken away Remploy. The reason that I've come to Remploy 23 years ago was because I could only get temporary contracts outside the industry because they don't want the responsibility of looking after us. And that's the difference, because we can't keep up with mainstream able-bodied people. What we do is 100%. We all put 100% into the factories, the business.
Okay, so what can you see yourself doing if this place closes down in a couple of months' time?
Dull, honestly. I can't see myself achieving anything outside. I really can't.
I'm Sue Moore. I'm shop steward for the Unite Union. Now, I think it's totally wrong what this government's doing. As Tina said, we're a viable business. We're earning money here. And why are they closing us?
But what the government's saying is that you're not actually managing to turn a profit.
Well, we don't turn a profit because the money is going elsewhere. We've got a pyramid of managers. And that's where the money's going. It's not going to disabled people. It's going to fit people, which they are. I think it should stay for the future generation. We've got servicemen are disabled. They're coming back from Iraq. Why can't they come here? We could set this up as a training facility for injured servicemen. Marie Miller said in Parliament that it was the top management killing Remploy, that the money was going to the top management on bonuses, and that's where the money's going. It's not going to the people in the factories.
My name's Doug Pine. I suffer bad from nerves. I've been with Remploy for 33 years. Before I come to Remploy, I went for 100 jobs. And because I don't want to be a burden to the state, that's why I would like to carry on working. And that's one of the that's what I want, just to carry on working. They should keep Remploy open for the future for disabled people. They could use Remploy for training disabled people into work and different things like that.
So what have you got out of being here then?
I got a heck of a lot. When I left school, Remploy helped me do my city and guild and different stuff like that in maths and English. And Remploy's been really good because I would have been on the dole and the rest of it if I wouldn't have come to Remploy.
So what will you do if in a couple of months' time I decide to close it?
I do not know, because I do not want to be unemployed again. After 33 years, I want to carry on working.
My name's Brian Williams, Site Quality Controller. I've been in Remploy for 10 years. Before that, I've been in outside industry, and I was on a contract at Asda for 2 years until Asda stopped getting a subsidy from Remploy, and all of a sudden there was no funding left for us. The biggest concern about us being two-peed across to other companies is that after the subsidies run out, Ian Duncan Smith have promised companies to look at buying into Remploy, is it will be slowly phased out, and there'll be no jobs for us after that, and there'll be no money for redundancies. I'd like to challenge Mr. Ian Duncan Smith to come to Bristol, have a look round, see what we do. See, he's already banned BBC from coming outside West, from you bringing their cameras into Remploy and talking to us.
Now, the funny thing is, we've had to actually come outside the building, haven't we, onto the pavement, just as everyone's finishing for the day. Yeah. Why is that?
There's a total media ban at the moment on Remploy as far as cameras and talking to the media is concerned. I'm born with cerebral palsy. Although I have been successful in the past in outside industry, I'm getting old now. The legs are going. In fact, they're gone. Like the people who were made redundant in 2008, 87% of them still haven't got a job. I fear it's going to be the same for most of us. There's a lot of management in Remploy that probably are all fit, all on big cars, laptops, mobile phones, that all costs a lot of money. To be honest with you, should you really be looking at whether Remploy pays? What about the service that Remploy could give to the community? With all these factories becoming work academies, we're very good at training here in Bristol. We could bring not only disabled people into Bristol, but youth unemployed into Bristol, get them a start in life. The wider effect to the community will be anybody out there who is really struggling to get a job won't have the opportunity to come to places like Bristol Remploy, get some work experience, get a reference, so they can say to the future employer, I made it to Remploy every day for 12 weeks, I worked well while I was there, and get a reference off of somebody like Tina.
Many of the people who have been productive here are going to be going on to the dole, aren't they?
Most of them will go on to the dole, and eventually most of them with their various disabilities will end up on incapacity benefit or whatever the government decide to replace his incapacity benefit, and that's meant to be totally against their policies. The longer you stay off of work, the worse you get. If you sit at home and do nothing, you lose the skills you have got, and you will just become not ready for the workplace. It's not just the work side of it, it's the support they get. They get to learn while they're here. If they have problems in the wider community, they can talk about it here, get help from the support from the people who have the knowledge. Everybody I know in Remploy wants to work. There is no one. The nine factories are at risk in Wells. They all want to work. They do not want to work for anybody else. They want to stay open as Remploy.
So any chance of saving Remploy?
At the moment, very little. But there's always a chance, I suppose, if we get enough word out on the street there and enough people kick off. Very disappointed in the local MPs. Kerry's been nowhere near the place. The Labour government seems to be happy that, dare I say it, and I'm a Labour voter, that the Conservatives do the rest of their dirty work for them.
We are fully loaded. We're short-staffed. There are plenty of disabled people out there who do want to work, but they're not going to give the opportunity. If this goes, what have we got? What have they got? Unfortunately, in our company, there are sites that is not fully loaded, but there are a load of sites that are. We have got a full order, but we've got good customers, as Tina said earlier on. We've got fantastic opportunities in Bristol itself for more work to come in. We just haven't got the manpower. They don't want to employ anymore because they want to get rid of us. They stopped employing people 10 years plus. Back then, I think, when Labour were in, they wanted to slim us down. Now the coalition's in, just want us gone completely.
That was a report earlier this week from around the back of Old Market, which is the site for Bristol Remploy. I'm joined by the UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke North, Ben Walker. Ben, what are your thoughts hearing what's going on down there? And particularly what seems to be pretty strong evidence that this particular plant is making money.
Yeah, that's really quite a strange situation to find themselves in, isn't it? I mean, I'd be interested to find out much more about where they do believe the money's going. I mean, obviously someone referred to managers being paid bonuses and you know, that's horrendous to start with. One of the things that I don't understand about any of these sorts of things, and when it comes to the coalition's stance on them, is that there are things within the country that aren't designed to make a profit. They are a service, and they're actually a service in the sense that it could be public transport, or it could be something that's actually for the betterment of someone's life. Now, this to me, it sounds a classic case of one of those. You know, these people are benefiting.
But it's not just that, is it? Because what they're saying is that they've got able-bodied managers up north in an office which, when on the good years where they've made profits over the last few years, they've taken a lot of that profit away in bonus, and they're able-bodied.
I mean, I can't believe that. Not that I can't believe it. I cannot believe that's happening, and I cannot believe it's being allowed to happen. It should stop. I mean, from my experience, and albeit limited with Remploy, they do a fantastic job, and it's a brilliant facility to have for people who, you know, struggle to get work in other places against able-bodied people.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this one, particularly on this aspect that it doesn't even seem to make, certainly from a very local point of view, economic sense? We've had 10 years they've actually been prevented from employing people. They've got a full order book. They're having themselves to work overtime.
Well, as some of the people pointed out, during the years of the Labour government, they were trying to slim it down, and the Condem government wants to kill them off. And I think, picking up on what Ben's just said, something like Remploy may or may not make a profit. Some bits will be profitable, other bits will not be. But of course, you've got to think, what's the alternative for these people? And the alternative is for them to be entirely dependent on benefits, probably. That's most likely the outcome, if you think about it, in a situation of mass unemployment for able-bodied people. If you put these people out of work from Remploy, their chances of getting employed somewhere else are just about zero. And so, actually, if you factor that in, then in actual fact, this is actually probably viable. It's not just the profit that Remploy makes. It's the costs to society of closing Remploy down. I mean, we had similar arguments during the miners' strike years ago about keeping pits open, you know, because if you put everybody on the dole, you're gonna have to pay them to be on the dole. So you've got to factor that in. And it just seems vindictive and silly. Something like Remploy has been built up over generations, and was a kind of originally conceived as a kind of a trust. You know, they talk about the military compact or whatever, that if you come back injured from fighting Britain's wars, whether rightly or wrongly, you know, we're going to look after you. And that was the spirit of the 1940s when Remploy was set up. And it doesn't seem very conservative to me to smash things that work for the sake of ideology, which is what seems to be.
No, I would absolutely agree with everything you've just said. It doesn't make any sense why they would want to close such a service and facility down like this. I would say, please, go off, look at the management, what's going on there, change that and get rid of them.
Well, maybe that will be part of this consultation, and you know, that some of these Remploy places will be saved. Because I think what Martin's point is probably the most important one, in a way, is that the actual ultimate cost to society is going to be far, far more, both socially and financially, if the place is closed. When I was wandering around the industrial estate, there are several units there that are just empty, and I'm concerned that the Remploy site will just join those as another kind of empty industrial unit, Ben.
Yeah, no, again, I would agree with that. I mean, it doesn't make much sense, does it, when that is really the only other alternative to that? I mean, where are these people going to go? They are going to sit in the welfare state, which is currently struggling on its knees anyway. I just cannot see the benefit.
Okay, on to the financial crisis now. A little bit more of the macroeconomics of it. Martin Summers, we've had a result from the Irish referendum over the Euro financial plan, and apparently the Irish people have said yes, they want to embrace it. They're the only people in the Eurozone that were actually given a choice on this.
Yeah, it says 57% to 43% here, and I think it was about a 50% turnout, wasn't it? Well, I mean, people are over a barrel, aren't they? We're going to see this, perhaps something similar in the Greek election in a couple of weeks' time. They're very fed up a bit what they're being told to do by the European Union, but at the same time, the alternative is that we're going to throw you to the sharks if you don't.
But what does that mean? It's throwing you to the sharks. Isn't that just trying to scare people saying that?
Enda Kenny, who's the toy sucker, the Prime Minister in Ireland, has basically been threatening people: if we vote no, we're going to, you know, our borrowing costs are going to go through the roof. I mean, there's been overt attempts by the Eurocrats, if you like, to influence both the Irish referendum and the Greek election, and they're basically being told, look, poor countries like you haven't got a choice, you do this or else. And of course, actually, when people are scared, they're not always brave. And they often decide to go the Irish have got a reputation for being rebellious, but in actual fact, I remember talking to a priest when I was in Bosnia, who's Irish. He said, we've got a reputation for being rebellious, but it's not, we're actually terribly, terribly subservient. That's actually the Irish way. And I would suggest that that's what we're seeing here. People are just scared of standing up for themselves.
Okay, so what's
the consequences?
If there is some sort of a euro crisis crash, and the Irish are locked into it now, as it seems they will be, who's going to be to blame for that?
Well, ultimately, the problems we're facing are rooted in the derivatives market, which is came out of financial liberalisation primarily in the 80s, but then it carried on. I mean, the thing about financial liberalisation, it doesn't just happen once. It gets more and more liberalised, so they come up with more and more complicated things to do, which are more and more risky. So it's not just we're going to do some risky things, it's like let's do all the risky things we can think of, and that's the real root of the crisis. And of course, the banks were bailed out in 2008. The free market policy, of course, would be to let the banks go down, as the von Mises Institute, who are proper free marketeers, argued. But of course, everybody blanched at that, because letting the banks go down means you're going to have a depression.
So what has the consequence been of not letting the banks go down, taking them over, nationalising them? The thing is, of course, if a bank goes down, the government can step in and take it over for nothing.
Well, yes, but what we've been doing is chucking money at them so that they can be resurrected as private banks. And that, of course, was a mistake. I supported the bailout of the banks at the time because I thought, right, if they bail the banks out, at last they can read them the Riot Act. But of course, the politicians, Labour politicians and other politicians, were just totally unprepared. They had no idea that something like this was going to happen. I don't know why, because academic economists of the right persuasion have been pointing out for years how dangerous this was. But everybody says, oh, well, the people in the city assure me that it's all fine and that's just scaremongering. They were wrong. And of course, the politicians were completely taken by surprise. They were presented with this baby and they went, oh, I suppose I better just put its nappy on. So they did. And they didn't know what to do once they'd done that. And there was no... most of the population don't understand these issues. You know, they just presume they know what they're doing. And we've got ourselves where we are. And it doesn't seem to matter, if you look across the Eurozone, it doesn't seem to matter what government you've got. They've actually lost control of the situation. So you can have elections, but it doesn't make any difference because it's all way out of control.
Ben, this is one of the principles on which you resigned from the Conservative Party and you've taken up the UKIP banner. What are your thoughts on this news that the Irish are essentially saying, well, actually, we're going to have to embrace this financial fix that's been cooked up in Europe?
Well, I think it's been said that they're left in a very difficult position, you know, yes or no. And I do strongly believe that there is a huge amount of scaremongering going on. I mean, the government here will say, you know, if we were to pull out of Europe, no one would trade with us. Well, that's utter rubbish, you know. We don't trade with countries, we trade with companies. And if we have a company here selling something at the best price, the best product, it meets all the spec, are you telling me that that country's not going to buy it from you? That's ridiculous. And the government, you know, it's criminal to go around saying that would be the case. And if you look at, well, yeah, you know, Ireland, I mean, I'm quite surprised. I kind of thought it would happen, but, you know, in my heart of hearts, I'm quite surprised. But with Greece, I mean, they are in a fiscal prison. They can do nothing and they just have to go along with this. And that is so unfair. I mean, I feel deeply sorry for the Greek people because they are stuck between a rock and a hard place. You have people in the background desperately trying to make the euro work and keep these people in that deprivation and recession. I mean, it's just got to stop. If you let Greece go, they're not just going to sort of burst into a smoke and flames. You know, they're going to get on with it. They've got a massive tourism industry. They'll get the Drachma back. They will dig themselves out, and they will become great again, like they once were. I think it's terrible to say, oh, you know, if they pull out, that's it. They're done and dusted. It's utter rubbish, and I think people should really just stop banging that drum.
But really, this is European business, isn't it? Because we're not in the Eurozone ourselves here in the UK.
Well, you would think not, wouldn't you? Yet we're the ones that implement all these silly laws that they introduce in Brussels. I know. I mean, we took it. The Labour government took a very sensible decision. We didn't join the Euro. I really don't know where we would be now if we had. It'd be interesting for someone to do sort of map that out and work it out. But I'm glad that happened, obviously. Where would we be now? I have absolutely no idea. But the trouble is, we're forced by this government and governments have passed to underwrite this super state.
So you think that maybe the countries that have joined the Euro, like Ireland and Greece and Italy, Spain, they're all having problems now. Do you think that they entered that thinking that they were going to be part of some sort of big sort of financial bloc, and now actually something different has happened, that they've lost something? What have they lost?
I think they've lost the concept. I think the concept was sold to them, and that's what everybody believed who was joining up to it. The trouble is, how can you actually fiscally link countries and have the same interest rates, the same currency? Every country is very different. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I like the fact that you get smelly cheese from France and great wine, and over here you get bitter, and it's all different. I'd embrace a Europe that's different and diverse. I just don't think we've got to be linked up fiscally and have everything the same, because I don't think it's possible.
Well, I'm very pleased to say it's time to welcome back, after a few months' absence, Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. We will talk about early learning proposals. According to a recent update published by the Department for Education, there are to be radical changes in the provision of early education for children. Current plans will entitle parents of young children to 15 hours of free preschooling education per week between age of 2 and 5. Some children are currently entitled to these hours, which must be taken over at least 3 days. Proposed changes will allow these hours to be taken over a 2 days period, with intention of achieving a better fit to parental working pattern. These hours are to be taken between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. 2 years old children entering preschool are to be given a special test seeking to identify potential development issues. The number of learning goals are to be reduced from 69 to 17, with a focus on 3 areas: personal, social and emotional development, physical development and communication and language. The plans to be introduced from September 2012 intend to allow greater parental and community involvement in early learning centres. 30 local authorities will share 3 million of additional funding to trial payment by result schemes. Financially hard-pressed local authorities are to be required to publish information of how much they're spending on children's centres within their area. The early years are a crucial stage in child's development, when the habits of lifetime are formed and the foundation of later education are set as a child's brain develops. All that seems to be lacking from the government proposals is the money to properly implement them.
Well, sounds like a great proposal, Ben, but is there going to be the money to implement it, I suppose, is the question. What are your thoughts about preschool children and education, this kind of education? I mean, one of the great things here is it seems that the learning goals are going to be reduced from nearly 70 down to 17, so there's not quite so much pressure on the children. It'll be more of a play environment rather than trying to sort of get them ready for school.
Well, my little boy, who he's now in reception, you know, reception at his first school, he went to preschool and he benefited massively from it. You know, when did he start? I think it was 9 months when he started to go, obviously due to work. But he massively benefited. His speech improved at such a rate, you know, it was unbelievable, against a child who wasn't going to preschool. Much better at his reading and writing, and just generally, you know, much more rounded and I want to say more intelligent, but that's not the case. You know what I mean? But yeah, huge advocate. I think it's a good thing. This proposal, brilliant, sounds great on paper. Yeah, as it's sort of said in at the end of the tail end of the report, where's the money? Because we don't have it. So I'm interested to know where the government, who are going to make this law, that local authorities are to sort of roll this out, that they're cutting the central government funds given to local authorities. I can't see where they're going to get the money from when, for instance, South Gloucestershire is in the second year of a four-year programme where it has to save £44 million. Yeah, you know, where is the money?
Martin.
Yeah, I think this comes to the nub of the question. Ultimately, I don't believe in a cuts policy. That's partly why I'm in the Labour Party, although in actual fact the Labour front bench don't quite understand the issues, in my view. Cutting public expenditure in the situation we're in now is in fact simply daft and idiotic. Of course, keeping the level of public expenditure up doesn't solve your problem. The banks are still bust. But it's like being in a car crash and saying, why don't we shoot ourselves in the head? That'll stop us being in the car crash. And it will, because you'll be dead by the time the car hits the wall. Now, not shooting yourself in the head, i.e. not carrying out cuts, still means you're in a car crash, but at least you haven't shot yourself in the head. Now, a crisis like this comes along once in a generation. And it's also an opportunity for people to say what they really want, because ultimately we have to, you know, the politics is going to get very interesting going forward. Now, if you look in the Scandinavian countries, in the 1930s, they instituted full preschool education for all children from the age of 2 onwards. And they kept them in preschool education until they're 7. So they don't actually go to school till they're 7. And they don't try and teach them to read till they're 7. So every child from every background, however poor or however privileged, they have solid years where they learn in the way that your boy has been learning. And it creates a fantastic social glue, because of course everybody doesn't mind their kids playing with other people's kids when they're 4. It's when they're being bullied when they're 14 that people start to worry about which school they go to and all the rest of it. Yeah. And of course the parent teacher committees which run these places bring all the community together. And if you think about it, if you want to deal with social disadvantage, nursery education, high quality nursery education, is a key building block. And they've had this universal nursery education in places like Finland since 1933. And it shows, doesn't it? Mm. We are still trying to reinvent the wheel. Now, ultimately, I would see the way out of the crisis as a new deal, so that the government basically gets a grip and says, right, where are we going with all of this? Let's have a plan. And one of the key elements in that plan should be nursery education. What about a whole new generation of state-of-the-art nursery schools on every street corner in the country?
But Martin, we've got to balance the books first.
No, we haven't got to balance the books. That is wrong. That is exactly the point I'm making. That is economic illiteracy. In a crisis like this, you don't try and balance the books. You try and have a deficit. Now, you can't just do it by deficit spending. Then you've got to ask the question, well, where is the money? And the money is in the pocket of the looting classes at the top. And because we bailed the banks out 4 years ago, there is no guarantee that they actually deserve the money that they're getting. If we hadn't bailed the banks out 4 years ago, Hargreaves Lansdown, for example, who are the biggest financial company in Bristol, might be bust. And so Hargreaves and Lansdown would not be there telling us how successful they are and how we've got to cut our pensions and all the rest
of it.
They would be on the dole with everybody else.
The trouble is a lot of this money is squirreled away in tax havens. In fact, something like 90% of it.
Indeed, but ultimately, when it's national survival, as it was in 1939, and that's where we're going, you ultimately say, sorry, mate. I mean, people say, well, I've got, but if you raise taxes on me, I'm going to run away to the Cayman Islands or Switzerland or whatever. You say, you can go, but you can't come back. You will lose your citizenship.
Yeah, but they don't run away because their money is over there already. They can just, I mean, it's almost like the old...
What you say to people is, if you don't pay what we recognise as your full whack in British taxes, and we're looking at all of your assets everywhere, then you lose your citizenship. And you can either have your citizenship or you can go and live in the place where your money is. And that's the choice we will face them with. And ultimately, it sounds radical now, but once we've had the crash, because the crash is coming, there is going to be a... People think there's been a crash. The crash is yet to come. And then we will see the unemployment shoot through the roof and people get really angry and people say, well, where has all the money gone? Oh, it's in your pocket in the Cayman Islands. Yeah. Now, ultimately, a lot of this has actually been fraudulent. During the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, several thousand executives were sent to prison. In the 1930s, the Pecora Commission sent hundreds of people to prison who were top executives. Nobody has been sent to prison in this time except Bernie Madoff. Now, ultimately, if we were to send a lot of these people to prison, we could confiscate all their assets because they're criminals. and that would be how we would balance the books. Sounds radical, but the alternative is what they did in China in the 1940s, where they put the whole existing ruling class up against the wall and shot them. And if people think that I'm exaggerating here, this is a world war level crisis. It really is.
Now, Ben, let's just get your thoughts on, you know, the idea of, is it possible to pay for this kind of nursery education, this preschool education?
No. In my experience and my understanding now of local authorities, I cannot see where the money is. And I absolutely agree. And by the way, doesn't he know his onions? But I absolutely agree that this sort of education, it needs to be mandatory. It needs to be funded by government. And it's not just now. Yeah, it's going to cost some money. But look at the other countries that do this now. They are light years ahead of us. Yeah. And yet we're always, as ever, playing second fiddle.
Okay, so finally, for both of you, how do we get this policy through to the top so decisions are made so these things can be funded, Ben?
Good question. Bite the bullet. Fund it. Someone's got to be strong enough, ugly enough, and hard enough to stand up and say, right, this is what we're going to do, this is a long-term benefit, and here we go.
Martin?
I totally agree with that, and if we can build a consensus around sensible policies like this, a cross-party consensus, then the masters of the universe, the people who've been playing fast and loose with the money, they are a tiny minority.
Yeah.
And if all of us, and those who are politically active who care, got together and said, no, we are having a state-of-the-art nursery system in Britain, come what may, come hell or high water, then surely we could have it.
Absolutely.
Okay, a couple of stories this week from the Leveson Inquiry, News of the World phone hacking scandal. We've had Jeremy Hunt, who is now facing a Commons vote over his handling of the News Corp bid for BSkyB. He's hanging on by his fingernails with his little smirky smile as the Culture Secretary, who was, bizarrely, Vince Cable was sacked for... being against the Murdoch purchase of the whole of BSkyB, and yet Jeremy Hunt seems to have been quite clearly for it. Martin, do you want to start on this one?
Well, I mean, you've just put your finger right on it. Vince Cable, because he unwisely was tricked by a couple of pretty girls into being unwise about Rupert Murdoch. I mean, that's the way the journalists work. And, of course, he was then taken off the case because he was obviously biased. But then Jeremy was wheeled forward to replace him because he was completely in favour. I think this is going to run and run until Hunt resigns.
Well, why hasn't Hunt resigned then?
Because Cameron has not been strong enough in dealing with it. He should have sacked him, but he hasn't, and therefore he will take the case.
Don't you think there are maybe consequences to him being sacked?
Well,
if
he sacked Hunt, Hunt would turn around and say, well, you backed me all the way on this, David. That's the problem. I mean, they've got themselves locked in now.
Okay, Ben, what's your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I think Hunt should have gone. You look at the sort of the text messages that have been sent, and once Cable had sort of been sacked, and then the little text that sort of said congratulations. It's an incredible situation. I think he should go. The reason he hasn't gone, I don't know. Maybe he's got something.
Well, what's the effect on the wider Conservative membership of this kind of thing?
Well, your grassroots Conservatives, I think, generally think this is all pretty disgusting, and they don't really have any knowledge of all this elitism and sort of brown envelopes and all that sort of stuff. You know, they're just on the ground trying to get votes for their town, district, parish seats.
Well, I don't imagine Jeremy Hunt thought these texts were going to be made public, did he, when he was texting around?
No, absolutely not. But I guess, you know, when you are a government minister, you know, there is another level of responsibility and transparency that you should really adhere to.
The other big bit of news this week is that Andy Coulson, the Prime Minister's press advisor, who wasn't actually security vetted, even though he was getting papers to do with national security, he has been charged now also with perjury this week. Now, this is to do with I think, Martin, it was about October, November last year, we actually did touch on this story of Tommy Sheridan and the perjury case.
We had his lawyer on, didn't we?
His press advisor Hugh Kerr on an interview with him. Could you just tell us what you think the implications of this are? Because this is a pretty serious, and it's complicated too, isn't it? It's perjury in a perjury case.
Yes, I mean, to simplify things, Tommy Sheridan is a very outspoken left-wing politician in Glasgow. I used to be studying in Glasgow at one stage, so I'm aware of who he is and his reputation.
He's a Scottish Socialist leader, and they were a party that was very much on the up.
They had six members of Scottish
They were on the up, weren't they? They were looking like a really serious threat to the SNP.
The problem was the News of the World printed stories about Sheridan's private life, that he was a swinger, he used to go to sex parties and stuff like this, all of which, in fact, is irrelevant to his role as a politician, frankly. But when he was when Sheridan was confronted by this by other Socialist Party MPs, he denied all of this stuff, and then the News of the World, that was the problem. I mean, what he should have done is what Galloway did, where he was having sex with lots of different women. He said yes, and your next question is what? But what Sheridan did is he tried to cover it up, which is silly of him. But nevertheless, it looks as if Colston, the News of the World, and Murdoch decided they were going to take down Tony Sheridan and the Scottish Socialist Party. So Sheridan went to prison. Scottish Socialist Party was riven with internal fighting, and they lost all of their MSPs.
Coulson testified that Sheridan had committed perjury.
What Sheridan was defending himself in his own trial, a civil case, and he said, You were hacking my phones and the phones of my family and friends. And Coulson, as you like, said, no, I wasn't. And that's why he's been arrested, because the police said, yes, you were. You were hacking his phones, weren't you? And, of course, he stood there and said he wasn't. That is perjury.
Yeah. Okay, what about the implications, though, maybe, Ben, for the sort of wider trust within... I mean, it was David Cameron that trusted this man, Andy Coulson. It now looks like he was a mastermind behind the phone hacking, because he was the editor at the time it was going on at the News of the World, to do his press work for him. It's maybe an ill-advised choice.
Well, it certainly looks that way now, doesn't it? I mean, it obviously goes hand in hand with the Jeremy Hunt story as well, and I think what hasn't been talked about a lot, and you kind of touched on it, Tony, is that... Alex Salmon, it's been muted this week, has been very close to the Murdochs as well. Mm. And that's interesting when it comes to this case, you know, that we're looking at now. And it's all very incestuous and disgusting, isn't it? And I think the more that the Leveson and obviously now the Coulson thing, this news story that's kind of sort of semi-linked, the more it digs up, I think the worse it gets for all these major parties.
Martin, what's the implication here? Because Tommy Sheridan was a serious threat to the Socialist Nationalist Party.
The issue here is that News Scottish International, because of its politics of Rupert Murdoch, didn't like the Scottish Socialist Party.
Absolutely.
And so basically the Scottish Socialist Party has had its legs broken. Now, this is not good for democracy.
No.
When people like Murdoch can go around breaking the legs of political parties they don't like, presumably with some help from inside, possibly the police and the security services. And I think it's the Strathclyde police are now trying to demonstrate that they are being absolutely even-handed.
Yeah.
You know, that they are not going to be... if people are going to come to our courts and lie... I mean, he lives in Dulwich, Andy Coulson, and that six Strathclyde policemen turned up on his doorstep at 6 a.m, having driven all the way down from Glasgow, and took him away in the handcuffs, you know. And I think that is a bit of a message to the elite down south, isn't it?
I have no sympathy for this guy, to be honest. I mean, he sat in Leveson and failed to think it was important to note that or explain that he had 140,000 in shares for News Corp. What's that all about? You know, this guy's as dirty as they come. And, you know, I hope he gets nailed.
Okay, on to another story. And this week there was a talk at the Friends Meeting House in Bristol City Centre about the National Health Service. And I spoke to the guy who's giving a talk, who's John Lister, and here he is now. So we'll have a listen to that and then discuss it afterwards. This is about... what he's suggesting is that possibly doctors could be radicalised into actually, when they're introduced into the new National Health Service, to actually keep it exactly as it is, because they, apparently, will have the power to do so.
I'm John Lister. I'm director of a campaign group called Health Emergency, and I'll be talking about the Health and Social Care Bill and what can be done to resist the implementation of the bill now it's on the statute book.
The health emergency sounds like the fact that we can't afford the NHS anymore.
The health emergency is the fact that our health service that we love and value is being substantially restructured by these government proposals, and lots of people are not aware of it. So it is a bit of an emergency to try to get some public awareness going and to look at ways in which we can still, using various levers, try to make it more difficult to implement this bill.
But the problem is we can't afford the old NHS. This is just too much money out of the public purse right now.
The Lansley Bill doesn't save any money at all. There's no actual money being saved there. In fact, it's costing $3 billion to implement. So this is not actually about money. The reality is that the NHS reflects the health needs of the population, and if there's a will there in the government, they can actually raise additional money to do that, as they can, for example, to fund wars in Afghanistan and other activities which they seek to do, building aircraft carriers, etc. You know?
So what will you be saying tonight to convince people that the NHS really is worth saving?
Well, the NHS is worth saving. It's a publicly funded, publicly provided service. It's a universal healthcare service. It's a model that has actually informed the development of enlightened healthcare around the world. And what we're getting offered instead is a market-style system based more on the American system, which is a global disaster area, you know, consumes 40% of the world's health spending, wastes 30% of it on administration, and wastes another... this is according to The Economist and the Reuters Institute, wastes $700 billion a year out of $2,500 billion. In other words, it's absolutely cosmic amount of money wasted and a hugely inefficient system. And Andrew Lansley is replicating that by his reforms in the NHS. In other words, we're going to waste more money on administration, more money on private providers, and deliver less in frontline healthcare to patients.
Ultimately, though, this government's got another 2 years at least to run, we think. They're going to do it. That's simply what they've decided to do. So what is the point of trying to stop them?
Well, the bill has various provisions in it which say, for example, that GPs are supposed to be in charge of various decision-making processes. What we're suggesting is that GPs use their opportunity and what powers they do have to actually keep the system pretty much as the way it is. Andrew Lansley has not won the support of GPs. He's not won the support of the rest of the medical profession. He doesn't have the support of any of the health professionals or the general public for these proposals. And we want GPs and health professionals to actually act on that and to make it as difficult as possible to carry through the proposals the way he saw them in the first place.
But this government is a democratically elected, John. Who are you to tell them that they can't do this?
This government did not have a mandate for these proposals. These were never put to the electorate. They were sprung on the electorate from 2 months after the general election in 2010. Nobody had seen them before. And it's clear that public opinion is against them, just the same as professional opinion is against them. So I think there is no mandate for these. There is no public support for them. And actually, the consequences of these changes will be hugely publicly unpopular. If government are forced to confront the reality of what they're doing by GPs being as awkward as they can, then I think in a number of cases we can actually hold this up and we can stop it happening long enough to hold on to the next election and get a chance to kick this lot out and get another government in.
John Lister there from National Health Emergency. Ben Walker, UKIP councillor up in Bradley Stoke. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, he's saying there that the whole thing was the Health and Social Care Bill was sprung on people 2 months after the last general election without actually being consulted on beforehand. What were your thoughts while you were still a Conservative about the whole business?
Absolutely agree with him. It was sprung on me. I mean, I was a Conservative in the elections for 2010. One of the things we campaigned on was no top-down reforms in the NHS. 2 months later, you can see the one we're having from space. It's ridiculous. And the fact that that was never mentioned, and now, you know, the reform that they're trying to roll out in the NHS, quite frankly, it's incredible. I can't believe it's criminal.
Well, but surely it does make sense to allow private companies to actually bid for the sorts of services the NHS is providing so they can have a look and say, well, actually, we think we can do that more cheaply.
Well, I think there's always been, or for a long time, there's been an element of private companies offering, you know, services and products to the NHS. I mean, my worry is, how far does it go with this? Does it get to the point where, like in Russia, you've got the pharmaceutical companies who kind of run the doctors, and they've all got big houses and are sort of really well off and loads of money in the bank? I mean, it's a bit worrying. I think we touched on it earlier. There are things that aren't designed to make money. They're there to provide a service from your taxes for the betterment of society and you as a person, your family. I think the NHS is one of those. Great if we can try and break even or run it a little loss, but come on, it's not all about making profit.
I think that's right, and I think I think the fact that we're agreeing about these things, I mean, the Conservative Party of old understood the public service ethos.
Yeah.
And I think that this has been this bill clearly was being prepared in advance because there's a huge amount of detail in it. So they didn't think this up in 2 months.
No.
They knew what they were saying. David Cameron knew what he was saying. He said he went out and said to the electorate, "No top-down reform of the health service. The health service is safe in our hands." And people generally believed him because they thought he was an old-style Conservative who actually believed in the health
I
service.
I did. I believe.
And that was definitely the pitch he gave to the electorate. And then 2 months later, this very complicated bill, which must have had loads and loads of work done on it before it was brought forward, that is not just disingenuous, that is lying. That's what that is.
Okay, Martin, on to our next story. Ashton Vale Stadium opponents are facing a hate campaign. This is in the Western Daily Press last Saturday. A campaign of intimidation is being waged against opponents of Bristol City's proposed new football stadium. People who've spoken out against the planned new complex have had bricks thrown through their windows and their tyres slashed, a report by the BBC has revealed. The man behind a town green application that held up the plans, the subject of a court anonymity order, also had his name painted on a wall and posted online, and the investigation found, which was although it had been ordered by a court that he should be remain anonymous. The 30,000 seater stadium of Ashton Vale was granted planning permission in 2009, but an independent inspector ruled the area should be made a town green a year later. However, Bristol City Council committee went against the recommendation and said only part of the land should remain a town green, which would have allowed the stadium development to go ahead. The matter was referred to a judicial review, where a judge in the civil proceedings said there was convincing evidence of incidents of harassment and intimidation. Ben?
Well, that's quite worrying, isn't it? I mean, I'm not... When it comes to the city stadium... I kind of put where I am with that, I guess.
You're in Bradley Stoke, yeah, so it's not really your issue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a Rovers fan for my sins, but there you go. With the City Stadium, come on, Bristol, it's the sixth biggest city in the country. Why have we not got a Premiership side or a big stadium such like this that we're trying to get here? I mean, the population of Bradley Stoke, I think in the last census, was 28,500. Well, that's bigger than Blackburn Rovers. They've got a Premiership side. Why haven't we got one? We need this.
But what about these intimidations, bricks coming through the windows and this kind of thing? Doesn't sound too good, does it?
No, that's not good. And you know, that's worrying to see that and read about that, because regardless of what your thoughts might be about the stadium, people have the right to say, you know, and display what they believe. Now, to receive sort of bricks through your window and threats of violence, you know, that's not a good place to be in. And I would ask, or I'd appeal to the people that are doing that, please don't do that.
And I'd appeal to the police to pursue it. Martin?
Yeah, I mean, I take your point about having a Premiership side, but frankly, neither City or Rovers are that good, are they?
No, they're losing the
grand. I'm from Merseyside, you know.
Okay, on to our final story. The anarchists are claiming responsibility for railway signalling sabotage in Bristol. Again, this is actually from The Guardian last Friday. An anarchist organisation claimed responsibility for two attacks on railway signalling. The group, calling itself the Informal Anarchist Federation, warned of further guerrilla attacks and sabotage to hurt the national image and paralyse the economy however we can. Characterising the Olympics as a spectacle of wealth in a time of austerity, it ended the statement saying it wanted civil war and that anarchy was unavoidable.
It's quite frankly disgusting. I mean, when you're sabotaging the railways, I mean, here in Bristol, our railway sort of infrastructure has had no substantial investment since 1970. Why are we wrecking what we've got?
Quite right. And the question is, are these people just idiots or are they provocateurs? Either way, they're wrong.
Actually, there's quite a lot of comments on indie media saying that they think that the police are involved in actually sort of infiltrating the anarchists.
I know many people who are anarchists who will be equally appalled with this. This is not the way to pursue your political goals.
No, it isn't.
OK, well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, the new UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke North, Ben Walker. After the news, the secret rulers of the NATO world are meeting, the Bilderbergers, as we speak, near Washington, in the heart of military-industrial complex country. So who's there, and why are the press and public both being kept away at the point of a machine gun?
3.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News. From